Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who assesses President Obama's speech to the Muslim world, separating the rhetoric from a commitment for substantive change in U.S. foreign policy. Janet Kreps of the Center for Reproductive Rights, who talks about the links between the election of Barack Obama, the murder of abortion provider Dr. George Tiller, and the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. And Kevin Zeese, Executive Director of VotersForPeace.us, who discusses the campaign to discipline and disbar Bush administration attorneys for authorizing torture of U.S.-held detainees. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Haqqani Network, loosely affiliated with the Taliban, is the most deadly insurgent group in Afghanistan. The group is credited with the 2008 assassination attempt on President Hamid Karzai, in which three people were killed. The network also planned the May 12th assault on government buildings in the city of Khost. In sections of southeastern Afghanistan, the network is so strong that it has set up a parallel government in many towns, and municipal officials feel they must carry a letter of safe passage from Haqqani. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the Haqqani's leadership is based in northern Waziristan, a tribal area in Pakistan. The group is better connected than other Afghan insurgent factions to Pakistani intelligence and Arab militants. Network founder Jalaluddin Haqqani gained his reputation in the 1980s as a top resistance commander against the Soviet invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. In the 1990s, he briefly joined the Taliban movement, but kept his distance after the Islamic movement took power. After the U.S. invasion in 2001, Haqqani became the top military commander defending the Taliban regime, but he only began attacking the Karzai government after U.S. bombing raids killed members of his family. Immigrant Maria del Carmen Garcia Martinez was recently released from a Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, detention center near Phoenix with her hand covered in blue ink and suffering a broken arm at the hands of federal agents. She had been arrested on a charge of forging a driver's license and resisting arrest. The charges were later dropped because the license was only expired. Garcia Martinez has lived in the U.S. for 19 years. The American Prospect magazine observes that her treatment by ICE was overly harsh and exhibits the willingness of the agency to detain undocumented immigrants on flimsy evidence under ICE's 287G program. In 2006, the Bush administration encouraged local law enforcement to assist federal authorities to apprehend so-called criminal aliens. President Obama's budget has decreased funding for the 287G program, but Obama supports the 2008 Secure Communities Initiative, which targets immigrants with felony records. But Joan Friedland, policy director of the National Immigration Law Center, says the Secure Communities program has a deceptively benign appearance. She charges that the program could punish both guilty and innocent immigrants and fails to distinguish why they were arrested and whether or not their arrests were based on racial profiling or were just a pretext for checking immigration status. Janesville, a small city in southern Wisconsin, saw its General Motors plant shut down just before Christmas, 6 months before the automaker filed for bankruptcy. The closing resulted in the loss of 2,400 jobs, nearly 50% of the workforce. In the early 1990s, the plant was making SUVs, generating huge profits for GM. Today, recent retirees fear losing their pensions and health benefits. In March, unemployment in Janesville, a city of 62,000, hit 15%, more than triple the jobless rate of a year ago. In nearby Beloit, where many auto workers live, unemployment hit 17% in March. That area suffered another blow when Chrysler announced it was moving its Kenosha engine plant with 850 workers to Mexico. Auto workers are disappointed with the Obama administration's strategy of pushing GM to close factories and file for bankruptcy. Workers had hoped that the government would restructure auto plants to make high-mileage cars as well as trains and buses. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Even before he took the oath of office as the 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama talked about his plan to speak to the Muslim world with an eye toward reversing the antagonism developed over the past 8 years of the Bush administration. On June 4th, that vision became a reality when Mr. Obama delivered an hour-long address from Cairo University in Egypt, heard around the world. In his speech, the president noted there had been years of distrust and called for a new beginning in an effort to seek common ground. He criticized the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq as a war of choice and said the U.S. sought no permanent military bases there or in Afghanistan. The president declared that the U.S. bond with Israel was unbreakable, but described the Palestinians' plight as intolerable. While calling for Palestinians to abandon violence, Mr. Obama also said there can be no progress towards peace without a halt to Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In reference to the international pressure on Iran not to develop nuclear weapons, President Obama spoke out against a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, but failed to concede Israel's widely acknowledged possession of a nuclear arsenal. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who assesses the Obama speech, separating the rhetoric from a commitment for substantive changes in U.S. foreign policy.
I think that, you know, there was in some quarters palpable relief because of some of the symbolism and, you know, a different tone from the last administration in many ways. But I don't think that there was a tremendous amount of difference in terms of substance. There was some. For example, he acknowledged the U.S. responsibility for overthrowing the democratically elected government of Iran in the 1950s. I believe that was a first for a U.S. president to acknowledge that. He talked about Palestinian resistance movements, not just terrorist movements. So that might have been some movement in terms of actual stance there. But, you know, there was so much high-flying rhetoric. For example, there was all this rhetoric about truth and we need to acknowledge the truth and so on and so forth. Obama, in his first news conference, was asked by Helen Thomas if he knew of any country that had nuclear weapons in the Middle East. And he said he didn't want to speculate. It was an obvious reference to Israel's nuclear arsenal. And since then, we've seen other indications that the U.S. is going to continue to refuse to acknowledge Israel's nuclear capacity. Well, that's not a dialogue based on truth if the U.S. government can't acknowledge this massive nuclear arsenal that Israel has, anywhere between 100 and 400 nuclear weapons. And additionally, I mean, who did he meet with? He met with Saudi Arabia's king, who he called wise, and with the Egyptian dictator Mubarak. These were the same figures who were the closest to the Bush administration. So all of the rhetoric around democracy and so on and so forth really doesn't seem to mean much in that context. And also, Obama appealed over and over again to nonviolence, telling Arabs and Muslims not to pursue violence as a means to their ends and so on. While he's, for example, escalating war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as continuing U.S. troops in Iraq, he says that they'll be out, but, you know, even if you scrutinize that in terms of contractors and other things, it seems far more open-ended than his rhetoric would indicate. So I do think that this is largely a triumph of style over substance.
When we look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has Barack Obama staked out any new positions here that could give us hope that there will be a breakthrough in terms of peace negotiations and an eventual settlement during his term in office?
I think he might have slightly opened the door, but not really done anything substantially. For example, George Mitchell, his Mideast envoy, is heading over to the Middle East. A big question will be, will he meet with Hamas? Hamas sent a letter through the feminist peace group Code Pink while Obama was speaking in Cairo, reaching out and citing international law. It was a very substantial letter. So so far, as best as I know, the administration hasn't responded to that in any way. A lot of people are talking about this apparent conflict over settlements with the Netanyahu government. But bear in mind, you know, other administrations have had similar stance against settlements. And they sort of wink and nod and maybe criticize Israel for it. But the settlement building continues. And now we're even seeing a more right-wing government with Netanyahu and Foreign Minister Lieberman. So he's opened the door to some level of dialogue, but he has not staked out a position that really questions in substantial terms the Israeli dominance. Even George W. Bush, if you go back to some of his speeches, talked about Palestine, talked about ending the occupation. Those things were in some of George W. Bush's speeches. So I think that people have gotten ahead of themselves in terms of the rhetoric of this speech.
Just lastly, is there an opportunity for U.S. citizens to influence U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East in a completely different direction? Do you think Barack Obama is open to such change, given his rhetoric, to actually make it happen if he's pressured sufficiently?
Absolutely. I think that's the real point. People may recall protests like the February 15th, 2003, you know, quasi-global protests against the invasion of Iraq shortly before it happened. Those were important, but it was a long shot that they would actually change the Bush administration, which was so intent on carrying it out. I think that that kind of activity, having global days of protests, or what Code Pink did with, you know, meeting with Hamas officials and, you know, getting this letter from them, that kind of citizen diplomacy, now could play a substantial role. You know, that there's sort of an opening. The Obama administration, whether you're a big fan of Obama or whether you're a substantial progressive critic of Obama, either way, I think that it's incumbent upon us to develop citizen action of some variety in order to push them into doing the right thing, or if you want to be more favorable, in order to give them cover for doing the right thing. So I think that that's the opportunity here, that Obama's opened the door for that kind of dialogue and action and global solidarity efforts and so on.
That was Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. Contact the Institute at area code 415-552-5378 or visit their website at accuracy.org. In the last week of May, two events occurred that could have a profound impact on the issue of abortion in the U.S. On May 26th, President Obama nominated Appellate Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor to fill the upcoming vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. The court is currently divided 5-4 in favor of abortion rights, with the departing Justice David Souter in the majority. Sotomayor has never ruled directly on the issue, but she did rule on the global gag rule, first instituted in 1984, which prohibits organizations outside the U.S. that receive federal funds for family planning from providing abortion services or even mentioning the option of abortion. Then, on May 31st, late-term abortion provider Dr. George Tiller was murdered while at church in Wichita, Kansas, in the tragic final act of 20 years of harassment by anti-abortion forces. Dr. Tiller was a victim of a previous assassination attempt and had his clinic bombed. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Janet Kreps, Deputy Director of the Center for Reproductive Rights, about the timing of Dr. Tiller's murder and what her group hopes to learn about Judge Sotomayor's position regarding Roe v. Wade, which guarantees a woman's right to abortion.
The ultimate motivation of the person who shot Dr. Tiller, obviously, and why he chose then and there to do it, is something that we probably will never fully understand, but I do think that we have to look at the environment in which this man was operating. As soon as President Obama won the election, we started hearing concerns from abortion providers around the country that they were worried that anti-abortion protesting and harassment and violence would escalate because extreme anti-abortion militants would feel that they had lost power and control. And unfortunately, the case has been that a number of clinics have seen increased protester activity, and have felt more threatened by protesters than they had during the Bush administration. So I think the environment became more hostile and is more hostile now.
Janet Kreps, certain groups, women's groups, have been unabashedly enthusiastic about the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, and others are somewhat more measured. And a lot of that concern, I think, for certain groups comes from the fact that she's mostly an unknown quantity when it comes to abortion rights, that in all the rulings that she's made in her long judicial career, she really hasn't made any that relate directly to that issue. There were some tangential issues, and in fact, your group was involved in one of those, and that was the case called the Mexico City policy, or opponents call it the global gag rule, which has been instated and revoked and reinstated as the first item of business of the last several presidents, practically.
When President Bush reinstated the Mexico City policy, the global gag rule, in 2001, we filed a challenge to that, arguing that it violated the First Amendment rights of the center and attorneys at the center, and that it also violated other constitutional rights to due process and equal protection. And that's the case in which Judge Sotomayor wrote the opinion when it came up to her court on appeal.
So what did she say about that?
Well, she ruled on all of our claims, but not in a way that really gives us any insight into her views about the underlying right to abortion. And so the main issue in the case was the First Amendment issue, the free speech claim. And what Judge Sotomayor said was, my court, the Second Circuit, has ruled on this question before, this exact question, and we're bound by that previous ruling. And in that ruling, this court rejected these same First Amendment free speech claims, and we have to do the same. And so in that case, she just applied controlling previous rulings and said that the claim couldn't go forward.
So it doesn't give you a lot to go on, I guess, in terms of where she might stand. Some groups have called for the Judiciary Committee of the Senate that has to start the process to confirm her to really try to figure out what her views on Roe v. Wade are. Is that something that you think is essential?
We do. We're not taking a position as to whether or not Judge Sotomayor should or should not be confirmed, but we think it's critical at this moment for her or any Supreme Court nominee to be asked firmly and directly about their views, because the balance on the Supreme Court right now in regards to abortion rights is very, very tenuous. If you can think about this as essentially three camps when it comes to abortion rights, or three judicial philosophies, in, you know, putting it in the terms that the Judiciary Committee members would be asking Judge Sotomayor about this. The three philosophies are: abortion is a fundamental right and should be very strongly protected under the Constitution. Abortion is a significant right, but a lot of government restrictions are permitted under the Constitution. And abortion is not really protected by the Constitution, and Roe was wrongly decided and should be overturned. And where a judge falls on that spectrum is really important, given where this Supreme Court is, which is we have four justices that we think probably would overturn Roe, and a few justices in that middle ground, which is that they'll allow a lot of restrictions on abortion, restrictions which in the end are going to deny some women their access to abortion because the restrictions are going to be too burdensome for them. And then we have real champions of abortion who think it is a fundamental right and should be strongly protected.
That was Janet Kreps of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Call their New York office at area code 917-637-3600 or visit their website at reproductiverights.org. As the first terrorist suspect held at the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, was transferred to New York City to stand trial in federal court, new revelations were published about the role former Vice President Cheney played in authorizing the torture of American-held prisoners. According to a report published in the Washington Post, Mr. Cheney personally oversaw at least four briefings with senior members of Congress where he defended the Bush administration's harsh interrogation program used against detainees at Guantanamo and elsewhere. The former vice president's direct role in defending the harsh interrogations had not previously been documented. Against this backdrop, a campaign is now underway to hold former Bush administration lawyers accountable for their role in authorizing torture. A broad coalition made up of 200 organizations filed complaints with state licensing boards on May 18th, seeking disciplinary action and disbarment of 12 attorneys who had advocated torture through the development of legal memos contravening U.S. law and international treaties banning torture. The 12 lawyers targeted are John Yoo, Jay Bybee, Stephen Bradbury, Alberto Gonzalez, John Ashcroft, Michael Chertoff, Alice Fisher, William Haynes II, Douglas Feith, Michael Mukasey, Timothy Flanagan, and David Addington. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Zeese, executive director of VotersForPeace.us, and the attorney who signed the complaints against the 12 former Bush lawyers. He discusses the goal of the campaign to hold accountable all government officials who authorized torture of U.S.-held detainees.
The complaints are against 12 lawyers in the Bush White House, the Bush Department of Justice, and Department of Defense. And these lawyers were a critical part of the torture program. Without them, this program would not have occurred. There was a lot of dissension in the CIA and the FBI and DOD about torture. Many thought it was illegal. Many feared prosecution if they participated in torture. And so having this legal shield, as false as it was, having this legal shield, made this torture program go through. And there was just an article we put up today on VotersForPeace.us based on emails from one of the Department of Justice lawyers who opposed torture and how he was being pressured by David Addington, the counsel for Vice President Cheney. They were being pushed to sign off on this memo. He was a deputy attorney general. He warned the attorney general and lawyers in the Department of Justice that they should not sign off on this, that it would come back to haunt them, that was a mistake. And the reason it's a mistake is because these memoranda, they're not an honest analysis of the law. They totally warp and manipulate the law in order to come up with some kind of legal reasoning to justify torture. They really warp the law. Then they start by redefining torture. Rather than using the torture that's in the law, the Convention Against Torture, which Ronald Reagan signed and is the law of the United States now, an explicit definition of torture. If you do mental or physical harm to another person in questioning them, that's torture. It doesn't require organ damage, doesn't require near death, none of those factors that the Bush-Cheney lawyers put into the definition of torture, that's not even relevant. And so they had to redefine torture in order to make this work, and that's what they did. And they should, if lawyers who use their legal license to shield and facilitate war crimes should not have a legal license. It's that simple, and that's what the complaints are about. And we've gone against the ones who wrote the memos, the ones who reviewed the memos, the attorney generals who were responsible, all three Bush attorney generals, the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, who later became attorney general, David Addington, who is the vice president's counsel, and there may be more complaints. We're looking at other lawyers in the CIA, some who are still in the CIA, and some who are left the CIA but were there, as well as some of the DOJ and Department of Justice and White House lawyers.
Kevin, what's the precedent for this kind of disciplinary action or disbarment in cases of torture or abuse of prisoners relating to federal government employees or people in the armed forces? What can you tell us about precedent here?
Well, torture, is not something that has been as openly out there as it was during the Bush and Cheney years. I mean, so it's kind of a new thing. For example, during the Watergate investigation, there were lawyers who were disbarred because of their actions in covering up those crimes. The legal ethics are pretty clear. You cannot use your license to facilitate crime. And your job as a lawyer is to give an honest legal opinion. And if you were giving an honest legal opinion about torture, you'd start with the definition of torture in the treaties and the law. You would explain that there are two treaties, the Convention Against Torture, the Geneva Convention, which the United States led the effort to have passed around the world. There's two federal statutes, one against war crimes, one against torture explicitly, And the Army Field Manual prohibits any kind of improper treatment of criminals, even less than torture. You know, any kind of degrading treatment at all is against the Army Field Manual. So now Jay Bybee, and who's now a judge on the second highest court in the country in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the author writers, and John Yoo, there's an Office of Professional Responsibility review of their actions within the Department of Justice, and any day now they could come out with a report recommending disbarment. And if that happens, I think the disbarment of those two increases greatly, and I don't see why it stops there.
If these lawyers are disciplined or disbarred, what does your coalition think about the accountability of George W. Bush, former president, and his vice president, Dick Cheney, who apparently were very much involved in the day-to-day management of abuse and torture of detainees held at Guantanamo and elsewhere?
Well, in fact, just last week, the Washington Post reported that Dick Cheney went to some of those congressional briefings at a time when Congress was starting to question the torture techniques after the Abu Ghraib photos came out. Dick Cheney went up and really pushed the Congress to stay silent. And so he did play a role, and we know that much, and we know his lawyer was heavily involved in pushing. And our view basically is we need to do two things beyond the bar complaints. First, we need to have an honest and open investigation about what happened. And the openness is important because we need to have the country hear about it, talk about it, and decide that torture is wrong. And torture is wrong not just because it's illegal, but wrong because it's counterproductive to U.S. interests. It produces false information. And so I think an open discussion is the first thing. The second thing is we need to have an investigation by a special prosecutor who's independent of the Department of Justice and able to pursue the law and the facts, gather the facts, and apply the law. And if it goes up to the Attorney General, fine. Goes up to the Vice President, fine. The President, where it goes, it goes. Let the chips fall where they may, and if it leads to Nancy Pelosi, that's fine too. We need to hold people accountable so this does not happen again. War crimes like this are what destroy nations. And if we don't stop and look at it and deal with it, it will come back again and again. We've got to say, no, this is unacceptable, and people will be held responsible for it.
That was Kevin Zeis, Executive Director of VotersForPeace.us and a board member of the group VelvetRevolution.us. For more information on the campaign to disbar Bush administration attorneys who authorized torture, visit the coalition's website at disbartorturelawyers.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Toth. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.